Okay, I think we're live, and I'm with the great Greg Johnson from Countercurrents, and we're going to talk Christopher Nolan's epic Dark Knight trilogy and all of those themes in. Greg's actually got a book. Greg's actually got a book which I've linked to below, The Dark Knight, which analyzes especially Batman, but more generally superhero films. Because they've got all of these themes in, and I was just saying to Greg before we went live there, I think it's important for us to analyze popular culture. Obviously, it's literally called Morgoth's Review, and people who like to watch my videos know that I talk about movies and stuff. But I actually picked that up from Countercurrents about 6 or 7 years ago, and I was amazed that they had a movie section that looked at these movies from our perspective. Usually it's a bit critical because most of them are liberal garbage. But in the case of The Dark Knight, we get a rare trilogy which is just absolutely packed with sort of dissident right talking points and philosophical ideas. Thanks for coming on, Greg.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I've never actually heard your voice before. So I've been frequently linked to things that you've written, primarily by Millennial Woes, who's a big fan of yours. And so I'm familiar with your work, but I haven't before now heard your voice. So it's a
very
pleasure. Yeah. So where are you from exactly? Or is that doxing you?
It's obvious. My accent gives away where I'm from. It's the northeast of England.
Right.
I cannot really hide which part of the world I'm from with my accent. It's right. The far north of England, the far northeast of England, just before you get to Scotland, is where I live. In a sort of the middle of nowhere, really, for English terms. But I've read all of the Dark Knight articles that was at Countercurrents, but I didn't know they'd all been collected together in a book.
Yes, yeah, we have, there are 21 or 22 essays in this book, because not only have I written a bunch of stuff about Batman films, a lot of other writers at Countercurrents have done the same. And when I started looking at all the things that were up, I thought there's actually a whole anthology's worth of material. So we have a book of more than 200 pages. And it deals, I'll just read the back cover, because that says it better than I could just extemporaneously. Why is Batman a staple of right-wing discussions and memes? The entire superhero genre is inherently anti-liberal. For even though superheroes generally fight for liberal humanist values, they do so outside the law. They are vigilantes, and vigilantism only becomes necessary when the liberal system breaks down. But the character of Batman, particularly after being rebooted in Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns and developed in Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, is not just anti-liberal, but decidedly right-wing. The essays in Dark Right show us why, focusing on traditionalist, masculinist, and new right themes in Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, but also exploring other films, comics, and graphic novels. Dark Right includes essays by the leading cultural critics of the new right, including editors Greg Johnson and Gregory Hood, plus Trevor Lynch, which is me under another name, Jason Reza Giorgiani, Christopher Pankhurst, Will Windsor, James O'Meara, Zachary Ray, Jonathan Bowden, Spencer Quinn, David Yorkshire, and Andrew Hamilton. So I highly recommend this. It is still available at Amazon.com, although I've been calling for people to boycott Amazon because they have deplatformed 17 of our titles. You can buy it directly at counter-currents.com, and we will ship it out to you as quickly as possible. We can't beat Amazon's 2-day free shipping, but with convenience comes censorship in the case of Amazon, and so in good conscience, I don't think any dissident right people should be supporting the world's largest book banner. But yeah, anyway, so the volume is I think, quite well edited, quite well written stuff. I've written a lot of the stuff in it. Greg Hood has written a lot in it. We have a couple pieces by Jonathan Bowden, and I mention him because it's his birthday today.
Oh, yes.
So we've been remembering Jonathan today, and there's a new video that's of Jonathan speaking at a BNP event that has been rediscovered, and we are in the process of trying to put that online really this evening, actually. The Countercurrents team is working away to get that online. So
that would be great if somebody can put that in the comments after it goes live, and I'll highlight it. That would be helpful. It's interesting as well, because Jonathan Bowden also had this concept of pulp fascism, where you can see sort of fascistic and dissident right ideas in pop culture, and he mentioned Conan as well as Batman and Dirty Harry. And I think, as you were saying there, there is a lot of the sort of it is a running theme, and I always think liberals get a guilty pleasure from looking at something like the Dark Knight throwing scumbags off the top of a building, or Dirty Harry torturing a man in a football stadium to find out where a little girl is, and they don't really know what it is they're looking at. I don't think they actually like it, because it's not political, and so they can feel kind of relaxed about liking it.
What they're looking at is the refutation of their worldview, but they're too thick to know it, basically.
Yeah, it's absolutely, and the running theme to begin with, where Batman Begins, is that you do have a traditionalist order, the League of Shadows, and they have this sort of what I thought was Spenglerian, that Julius Evola type view, where we are now in the Kali Yuga. We are in the Dark Age, and they want to crash the civilization as fast as possible to get to a new Golden Age. I think that's a good way to kind of kick off. And of course, Batman goes along with that to a certain extent, but eventually his liberalism kicks in and he goes against it.
Yeah, exactly. He's supposed to render justice to a murderer. And he says, shouldn't this man be tried in a court of law? He basically cucks out on his vigilantism. At a certain point, there are lines that he won't cross. But then, of course, that gets him into a fight with the League of Shadows, and a number of them get killed, and their headquarters is burned down and everything like that. So he's willing to kill quite a lot of people in order not to kill a murderer, basically.
Yeah.
To engage in extrajudicial execution, but then he engages in extrajudicial execution. And so he's tied in knots and does contradictory things based on his commitment to this kind of fuzzy-minded liberal humanism that fundamentally contradicts what he's up to. And there's an essay in the book that I put out under my own name. It's basically about superheroes and sovereignty and the deep state. It's called Superheroes, Sovereignty, and the Deep State, exactly, by Greg Johnson. It's in the book. It's also up at Countercurrents. And I relate superherodom to the idea of sovereignty in Carl Schmitt. Carl Schmitt argues that the liberal idea that we can be ruled by laws, not men, is ultimately illusory, because laws have to be applied, and they're applied by men. And sometimes there are situations that the law does not foresee, and therefore that the law, you can't come up with a just solution by following laws that have been set down by other men. And you need people to make decisions. You need people to legislate, not just follow laws, but legislate. And then there are circumstances of great emergency, basically, when the legal system as such comes into crisis. And the person who steps forward to decide that there is a crisis and what to do in that crisis is the person that Schmitt said is the true ruler, the true exerciser of the sovereign function. And therefore, the liberal idea that we can have rule of law, not men, breaks down. That situation, that state of the exception, that state of emergency that's not provided for by the legal system, parallels the situation of the superhero and more broadly the vigilante, because superheroes and vigilantes as a whole group only operate really where the existing legal system fails, where it fails to do justice, where it fails to be able to fight aliens or whatever, right? When the system breaks down, then you need the vigilante. And one form of vigilante is the superhero. So, and I also talk about how this notion that you get out of really Turkish Islamist discourse called the deep state, which has now been adopted in the West. The idea of a deep state is a network of people who exist within the government and outside the government, outside the official institutions of the government, who take ultimate responsibility for preserving the system. And in Turkey, they had this idea of a deep state as a secret network that preserved the Kemalist political order set down by Ataturk, basically from Islamists, from communists, and from Kurdish separatists. And the deep state launched a number of military coups, I think four military coups in Turkish history to preserve the system when it entered into crises. And that kind of function is, again, the kind of function, a sovereign function, and it's analogous to the behavior of superheroes and superhero comics and movies. So I think what seems to be superficial and really massively overdone entertainment now, practically every other big movie is a superhero movie, actually does raise really important philosophical issues about the nature of government and power and so forth. And I think is a useful way of opening up a critique of liberalism.
Yes. What's interesting is that Ra's al Ghul, he actually explains to Batman a little bit later on in the movie that they had managed to infiltrate, the League of Shadows had managed to infiltrate the entire spectrum of the government, the authorities, the police. Everything was infiltrated and corrupted by the League of Shadows themselves. And he's asking Batman, what is it that you think you're trying to save? It's mm-hmm. all completely beyond hope. And that you should just allow it to die, which I think is fascinating. They're accelerationists.
Yeah, they're pedal to the metal accelerationists. And they've been around for thousands of years, apparently. They claim that they were the ones who brought down Rome and Byzantium and loaded ships with plague rats and things like that. So it's a really, really intriguing idea. I have an essay at Countercurrents called Metapolitics and Occult Warfare, where I talk about the idea of an initiatic order as a metapolitical concept. And I'm commenting on ideas put forward by Guénon and also Evola. Evola actually has this notion of occult warfare. And I relate it to, you know, what we are talking about, metapolitics, which is basically creating conditions for political change. But it also relates to the idea of a deep state, too. And one of the staples of conspiracy theories about the deep state, talks about secret initiatic orders, you know, the Freemasons, the Skull and Bones, things like that. You can have these sorts of societies that are there to preserve a society in times of crisis. And it's also possible to imagine these sorts of secret orders there to accelerate the collapse of a society in time of crisis.
Yes. And so it questions that Batman's ethics again, because I don't understand what Batman's argument is against them crashing it into the ground, except for being a liberal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he says there are good people here, people who believe in goodness. And yes, there are good people, and there are people who believe in goodness and this and that, but it's not enough. There are not enough good people in Batman, in Batman's Gotham, to save the city anymore. And that's really the problem. And, you know, I, being an American, being patriotic, I feel duty bound, for instance, to try and save my society from catastrophe. And when the Trump campaign came along and he was saying the right kinds of things about preserving America and preserving basically the white majority from demographic decline. He didn't speak that way, but he was putting out policies that would have accomplished that. I felt duty bound to support him and promote him. It's so interesting to see, though, how the system has slowly worn him down and co-opted him. Now I'm starting to think, well, you know, if there's not a deep state that is that basically my view is that, how to put it, there are not enough serious men in America to save this country. And when we elect a guy who makes all the right noises and then through some astonishing collapse in character, he just can't do the things that he promised to do that are absolutely necessary. I just came to the conclusion, you know, there are good people in America. There are patriotic people. There are sensible people, but there just aren't enough to save the country. And that's the situation that Gotham is in. And Ra's al Ghul believes that. Unfortunately, Batman, Bruce Wayne, just can't bring himself to believe it yet.
Yeah.
But really, the arc of the three movies shows that that is correct. The end of The Dark Knight Rises basically shows that there just aren't enough serious men, good men in Batman, in Batman's Gotham, to save that city. You give these people power and they behave like monsters, right? And you can try and save the city through the sacrifice, through the death or the apparent death of some of its best citizens. But at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, is it really worth the sacrifice? Is it really worth the sacrifice of the best people in a society to keep a corrupt society lurching along in the general direction of the abyss?
Yeah.
And it's an important question, and it's a real question with real tragic import, because, you know, I can understand why. Again, Bruce Wayne, being a loyal son of his hometown, wants to save it. And he knows that there are good people and wants to believe that there are enough good people and that with enough heroism, it can be saved. I've come to the conclusion that Ra's al Ghul was right, though.
Mm-hmm. I remember when Trump first threw his hat into the ring, there was some more cynical commentators around in nationalist circles, and because there was a clip that came out of Trump actually telling a little boy that he was Batman.
Yeah, I loved that.
Yeah, and it was very, and so of course, sort of people in our circles had been looking, especially at Countercurrents, had been looking very closely at the Dark Knight movies, and there was this idea that Trump, with all his charisma and his money, and it's sort of the last wasp, was coming in to kind of hold the Republic together against all of the corruption and all of the slime. But as it turns out, he just went with it in the end. But again, it is a theme which just keeps popping up, and it's very interesting to look at.
Yeah. Basically, he went with the path of least resistance, and it's always easy to give Israel what it wants and the Jewish lobby to get what it wants. It's always very easy to do that, but it's not easy to give the American people what they want. The entire political establishment in America is hell-bent on preventing the people from getting the kind of government policies that they really want. What people want is basically a socially conservative regime that is populist, that uses government intervention to help the working class and the middle class attain a decent standard of living and protect them from the depredations of elites and globalists and capitalists. And we never get that. We don't ever get that. Instead, what we get is more and more of what the elites want, which is basically the opposite. They want more globalization. They want more oligarchy. They want lower working and living standards for working class people, and they want socially liberal degenerate values to reign in society. They always get what they want, no matter what the people say. And of course, watching what happened with Brexit, the continuing ongoing soap opera of the betrayal of the British people is very, very enlightening. And of course, we've been seeing the same thing for the last couple of years in the United States with the Trump administration.
Yeah. we've got a super chat. Hi, Morgoth. Hi, Greg. I hope you're well. $20 from Sergeant Steele. Have a nice steak and a beer on me. Thank you very much for that, Sergeant Steele. I'm not used to getting super chats. I've got them being sent to us. So thank you very much for that. One of the things that's interesting there is, I think, in the throughout the trilogy, is the, a bit of a contempt for what we would call normies. You were just talking there about the sort of the contempt that the elite has for them as well. But there's also a certain contempt that the villains have for the normies, as we would say now, the average Gothamite is sort of they're not very smart. The cops are all corrupt, as you were saying. They're just waiting for their pensions to come in. They don't really have any higher values. They just want to go along to the football game. And people, you know, we'll get onto the joke in a second, but even in Batman Begins, they've got this hallucinogenic drug that the League of Shadow uses for enlightenment. And they have this plot to sort of to fill up Gotham's atmosphere with it. And when normies are exposed to it, it sort of drives them mad. It's this distinction where they can't be enlightened like the League of, they are just like a sort of underclass, which is a quite brutal way of looking at them. In the Marvel films, it's much different. The heroes themselves are very much of, they are normies, if you know what I mean. In Nolan's Dark Knight, there's a definite sort of hierarchical structure to the characters in the movies.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The toxin in the first movie is interesting, though. What it does is it accentuates your fear, basically. And strong people can overcome fear, and weak people collapse under it. But in the case of the toxin that's being released, though, nobody can really stand up to it because it's been so accentuated and made so potent that basically it just drives people mad. It even drives Bruce Wayne mad, at least temporarily when he's exposed to it, because he's actually undergone this test and he's overcome, you know, his fear of bats, basically. It's not really a fair test for the people of Gotham, though. it really is something that even the strongest of them couldn't overcome.
Yes, that's right. Moving on, we get into the Dark Knight. The Joker's not a member of the League of Shadows, but this is what everybody's favorite sort of villain of all time. There's a lot to be said about the Joker. I know you've had some great points in your book. But just as an entry point, he really shows the liberal values up, doesn't he? He really goes to town on turning the values of liberalism inside out, and it drives Batman to complete destruction, where he just kind of accepts, I cannot deal with this, while remaining in the liberal paradigm. And he sort of invents this gigantic surveillance system. He has to invent his own mini police state just to try and deal with the Joker.
Yeah, and the Joker is always trying to get him to kill, right? Batman wants to be a vigilante. And he ends up killing a whole bunch of people at the very beginning when he defects from the League of Shadows because they don't believe in legality, right? He wants to be a vigilante. He wants to go outside the law. He wants to be an avenger. You know, he wants to do good. And yet he has this rule, and his rule is don't kill anybody. And the Joker's whole purpose, or one of the Joker's main purposes, is to get him to break his one rule, right? Which is to recognize that he's got to decide. He's going to decide matters of life and death. And that's the thing. As a vigilante, he is a decider. He is empowering himself to be outside the law, deciding who's the villain and what needs to be done. But he still wants to have this one rule that he can't kill. And of course, the fact that he doesn't kill the Joker, and the Joker gives him opportunities. There's this scene where he says, you know, hit me, come on, run me down, hit me, you know. And Batman chickens out. He won't do it. He won't just execute the guy. And because he won't just execute the guy goes on killing people, right? It's an absolutely fascinating exercise that he does. It's a giant experiment. And the way I put it in my review is, what do you call a person who's willing to die to prove a point about morality? Well, you'd call him a philosopher. And the Joker is a kind of philosopher. He's trying to teach a philosophical lesson. And the philosophical lesson he's basically trying to teach is this. There's a political lesson, which is that you have to choose. If you're going to be a vigilante, you're going to have to kill. You're going to have to be judge and jury and executioner. You can't do this stuff outside the law and then leave them for the courts, right? The corrupt courts that put them out on the street again in the first place, right? You've got to go all the way. And so he's trying to push him in the direction of fully embodying and embracing the Schmittian sovereign function. But there's something deeper about him than just that, because the Joker feels that he can kill, that he's got license to kill, because he's made peace with his own mortality and that he's willing to die. And that's the thing that's so interesting about him. He is, he's kind of a Superman. He's kind of an Ubermensch because he has no fear. And the reason he has no fear is because he's put aside the fear of death. And not only has he stopped fearing death, he has a kind of erotic attitude towards death. He's constantly daring it to take him, the reason why he does that is because he realizes that by coming to grips with his own mortality and embracing it, that is empowering. That makes him free, and that makes him essentially fearless, right? Yeah. And so there's something, he's kind of an existentialist Ubermensch. The trouble is he's also, a sociopath. He's a nutcase. But there's something about him that's more powerful than Batman, and always remains more powerful than Batman, because Batman never gets outside his rules. He doesn't break his rules. He manages to skate by and stop the Joker without breaking his one rule. And the Joker says, we're just destined to do this over and over again. This is an irresistible force meeting an immovable object, right? Yeah.
And he has no history either. He's just, like you said in the article, he's completely free from the system. He doesn't have fingerprints. He doesn't have tax records, or you don't know where his clothes come from.
And that's a theme that comes up in The Dark Knight Returns, the idea of becoming free from the system, unreachable by the system, because that's what Selina Kyle, the Catwoman, wants. She wants this program that can wipe away her record and free her. And I thought that's an interesting theme that runs from the two things. And of course, Jonathan Nolan, who worked on these movies, on the scripts, and then went on to do Person of Interest, which is a great TV series about the surveillance state and stuff like that. They're very interested in this kind of theme. How does one become free in a world of pervasive surveillance and record keeping and so forth? Well, the Joker has made himself free in that way. He is unclassifiable. He's they don't know who he is. They don't have his fingerprints, his DNA. They don't even know where he buys his clothes. They're all unique. I love his answer to the question about how he got these scars. Every time he tells a different story, and that is sort of interesting, because of course one of the old saws of sort of modern Hollywood is the trauma psychology, this sort of fruity Freudian idea that people's malfunctions in life stem from primal traumas, right? And of course, you sort of have that with the bat thing in Bruce Wayne and the murder of his parents and stuff like that. But the whole point is that he overcomes that, which I think is good. But the Batman is also, the Joker has also overcome his past in a very different way, because he's got scars, you know, physical scars, as well as obviously psychic scars, and they don't matter. And the way he communicates that they don't matter is that every time he tells a different story about how he got them, right? They just don't matter. I think that's a really interesting indication of his independence, his freedom as a human being. And that particular point about the scars is something that comes out in one of the essays in the book. It was first brought out by James O'Meara in one of the essays we have anthologized. And I think it's a rather brilliant point, actually.
Yeah. Would you say the Joker as a Nietzschean archetype? Because you mentioned in a lot of the work at Countercurrents that what Hollywood do, and we all know who run Hollywood, what they do is to put sort of profound truths into the mouths of villains and psychopaths. And I thought it would be interesting if the Joker, taken into account what we were saying before, if the Joker is a sort of Nietzschean archetype and deliberately ruled out as being a psychotic.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is one of the tendencies that exists. Anti-liberal values can only be suffered in contemporary society if they're placed in the mouths of monsters. And this is why monsters are so valued and so interesting, right, in film and literature. This is something that Jonathan Bowden talks about. We have a book of his essays on popular culture called Pulp Fascism that's available at Countercurrents as well. And I think it's a perennial thing. The whole realm of strength and, if you will, aristocratic, archaic values that, of course, Nietzsche is referring back to in some ways, all of that whole dimension of sort of pre-Christian value system is, first of all, what Christianity did is they turned it into the devil, right? and the devil's legions and all the things connected with the devil and evil, they inverted the strength-centered aristocratic values in the ancient world and basically literally demonized them all. And in modern liberalism, the same process has been updated. Instead of just demonizing it, it's also psychologized and psychopathologized. And so these things appear in the mouths of criminals. These truths appear in the mouths of criminals and crazy people. And the Joker is one of these guys. Yeah, but I do think that he speaks certain truths. He's clearly alluding to Nietzsche, because in the very beginning scene, he says, you know, I believe that what doesn't kill you simply makes you not stronger, but stranger. But that's an allusion to Nietzsche. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also think that there's a strong sort of Heideggerianism in the Joker as he's portrayed in The Dark Knight, and then also in The Dark Knight Rises, in two senses. One, there is the sense that you're coming to grips with your own mortality, recognizing that you can die at any moment, is actually a liberating thing. It liberates you to be more authentic. It forces you to take stock of the fleetingness of life and the speciousness of a lot of the things that worry you. It helps you overcome a lot of silly little fears that are far less fearsome than death, after all. And if you can own up to the fact you're going to die, you can maybe even disappoint your mother, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a very Heideggerian theme. And the other thing is really the struggle against modernity as a kind of iron cage of availability and manipulation, transparency, surveillance. This is Heidegger's notion of the technological world as a world where to be is to be available to manipulation and transparent to knowledge. And our our very humanity depends on resisting that.
Yes,
exactly. And, yeah. And so for somebody, for me, because I share that view, I look upon somebody like Julian Assange, who's in the news now as a hero. Why? Because he helps throw, and I know he harmed a lot of people in the British National Party in one phase of his career, but he and people like these various whistleblowers, on the surveillance state, have struck blows for humanity against this all-encompassing technological surveillance and control system. And anybody who can bring that system down or throw a spanner in the works of it is a hero in my book. And the Joker really gets that, right? That's why he acts. That's why he acts apparently randomly. And one of the contradictions in the film is that he says, he'll stake his life on the flip of a coin, a real flip of a coin, not a rigged one. Yet he says, do I look like a guy with a plan? And yet he has obviously very, very well worked out plans that are sprung in the movie. So that is a little contradictory. But, he gives this little speech when he's trying to gaslight Harvey Dent after his face has been half burned away. Upset the established order, inject a little anarchy into the world. And that I totally agree with. We need to stop the iron cage, the surveillance state, this technological dystopia that powerful people are trying to create around us. And yes, we're using the internet, right, to do that. The internet is one of the greatest tools of surveillance ever created. They, years ago, people would kill you, if you tried to pry into their private lives. And today, they're all sending dick pics to one another,
yeah.
Over the web, and it's all being stored and kept for use. It's all going down in your permanent record, right?
Yeah.
And but at the same time, the internet is also something that they can't fully control. And I think that it's spinning out of their control, and I think it's one of the great instruments of subversion as well. And frankly, I think the establishment is going to rue the day that this thing was ever allowed out, because they had so much more power when there were a couple TV networks and a few major newspapers, and basically they controlled everything that people read and saw and thought. And today, that's really undermined it. But at the same time, it's also a double-edged sword, and it's been a massive tool of control and surveillance and invasion of people's privacy.
Yes. I'm going to read out a few super chats before we move on to Bane and The Dark Knight Rises. We've got Dirty D disagrees. $14. I got that wrong before. Hey, gentlemen, great content. Keep up the work. Are you familiar with Marshall Ironsides? No, I'm not. Are you, Greg? I don't know what that is. Marshall Ironsides?
No, I'm afraid I don't know. I'll have to add it to my, jot it down on my pad and look it up later.
But Hank Thuwank, £10. Thank you very much. Marky Mark Ali, £14.88. Hi, Greg. I really loved White Nationalist Manifesto. The cabbage lettuce analogy is such a great debate point against lefties. Can you say hello to my son, Gabriel?
Hello, Gabriel. You've got a smart dad. Thank you, Marky. I appreciate your reading the book and appreciating it. And I hope you'll pass it on to others.
And we've got Juan Doe, £14.88 again. Whoa, great guest, Morgoth. Thanks to both of you for putting yourselves out there. Keep fighting the good fight. It's more appreciated than you realize. Well, thank you very much. And these super chats are more appreciated than what you realize as well. So thank you very much for that, everybody. One of the things I was going to get into as well was in The Dark Knight, there's the famous scene where the Joker's rigged two boats with explosives.
Mm-hmm.
And it really brings the different sort of themes all together perfectly, because I'll explain in case, you know, maybe people have forgotten. But basically, the Joker has a prison full, a boat full of prisoners who are complete scumbags, and that's rigged with explosives. And then it's got the nice, decent people, which he kind of says of sarcastically, the normal sort of normies of Gotham, on another boat, a ferry going across a river, and he gives them both the detonators. And what he's trying to prove is that when the chips are down, the good people of Gotham will blow up a boat full of scumbags to save their own necks. So then that sort of animal energy comes back in pure sort of survival Darwinian terms. He can rekindle them. He can bring them back to life in that way. And he fails. I thought it was funny when you pointed out they couldn't even make that decision without having a little democratic vote on the board. And then even when they decided that, yes, we should blow up the scumbags to save ourselves, the man in charge of to push the button, he couldn't bring himself to do it. And so they all just sat back down waiting to die. But Batman thinks they've just shown you that there's good people in Gotham. And this is the only time in the movie that the Joker is actually stumped. He's actually genuinely surprised because there's just no saving these people. No matter what you do, they're just like a sort of herd of cows. He decides just to blow them both up.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. They really are just they're just sheep, and but that's what the modern value system has turned people into. It's just turned them into sheep, and the Joker is obviously disappointed. He's disappointed. He thought they were better than that.
And they're sitting there. I mean, they're sitting there with their children and stuff. And it reminds me of when you see whenever there's a terrorist attack or something, and the British government or European government or wherever are always like, okay, we have to kind of watch out for any kind of backlash. We've got to protect the Islamic community and everything like that. And nothing ever happens. And they, of course, the sort of leftists will say that they're showing their goodness, but from a perspective of like the Joker, they're just showing their weakness. It's pathetic to behave like that.
Yeah, and it's truly pathetic. Yeah. They won't even take their own side in a fight to the death, basically, and that is just the clearest way of understanding that these people are, they're degenerate. I mean, they're very sick. They're not healthy people. Something has gone out of them, and what's gone out of them is they have been they've been corrupted by liberal values, basically.
Yeah. And so you begin to see the point of the League of Shadows and Ra's al Ghul. It's not just that it's financially corrupted and all of the politicians are scumbags and everything. It's that the people themselves are just, they're spiritually rotten. There's nothing there, no dynamism, no energy, no will to live. And you really begin to kind of think maybe they've got a point.
Yeah. These are not movies that prove that Gotham is full of good people. It's really not. Or if they're good, their goodness is defined in basically terms of lacking vitality and self-worth and the will to do justice, the will to preserve themselves. They're not good people.
And I hope the people in the sort of listening to this now begin to understand why me and Greg Johnson have such an interest in the Dark Knight trilogy. There's some really out there ideas in these movies. And it doesn't come along very often in Hollywood. It would be nice to get more stuff like this, but it is sort of built for the people who will just sit on a boat and wait to die rather than take action. That's the general fodder that comes out in Hollywood. But these movies are a little bit different.
Yeah, they definitely are.
And they, of course, when we go into The Dark Knight Rises, Bane comes along and he proves the point yet again. And this time, I liked how you said it in the article. There's a contempt for money as well throughout these movies, which we'll get into in a bit. But the Bane is essentially using a sort of a communist revolution to free the people, because they know it's cynical. They know that when you do give the people this kind of, they're just free to do whatever they want, it does lead to a nihilistic bloodbath every time. And he cynically manipulates the people and sort of proves the point that they're not fit for anything and they need, well, they just, in his case, it would be they need to be blown up and destroyed.
Yeah. The theme of money in both The Dark Knight and in the Dark Knight Rises is interesting. The attitude that is projected both by Bane and by the Joker is a classic aristocratic attitude towards money. And, you know, aristocrats, they like to have their big fancy houses and their big fancy parties and things like that. I mean, they do appreciate these things. But there's a difference between them and the bourgeoisie. And the main difference is basically this. Luxury in its primal sense is actually not a way of indulging the senses and indulging your material pleasures. It's a way of showing that you're above them in some way. And the best example of this kind of activity is the potlatch ceremony that's practiced by these Indians of the Pacific Coast in America and Canada, basically. These Indian tribes would compete, prominent men in these tribes would compete for status. And the way they would compete for status is they would turn material possessions into status, first by giving them away. And this, of course, was true with the ancient Greeks, people like that. The conquerors, right, would conquer a foreign country and bring back the treasures of it, and they divide up the treasures, and they would compete with one another in ways to give the money away by endowing the city with magnificent buildings or buying it a warship, things like that. They tried to convert private money into public prestige. But the most extreme version of this competition amongst these Indians in the Pacific Northwest would involve actually destroying wealth, right? Because the whole point of giving something away is to show that you are independent of it, that you can live without it. But when the competition got fast and furious, sometimes they would actually compete to destroy wealth. They would heap it up and burn it, literally. And this is one of the things that the Joker does in The Dark Knight. He has this vast amount of money that he's gotten from this money launderer. And he douses it with gasoline. He says, "I'm a man of simple pleasures. I like gunpowder and dynamite and gasoline, you know," and he says there's one thing these things have in common: they're all cheap. And then he lights this mountain of money on fire. Yeah. And you could see this this very bourgeois villain, this Chechen gangster, his face just sinking. You know, he says, "Don't worry, I'm only burning my half of the money," which is even better, right? He's burning his half of the money. And then he says that Gotham needs a better class of criminal, and I'm about to give it to them. And a better class of criminal means a more aristocratic, less bourgeois criminal, somebody who is interested in doing something else than just accumulating private wealth. And for the Joker, that something else is teaching people some important moral lessons about the nature of the world and about themselves, and hoping that they might transcend bourgeois modernity. And he's very much disappointed in the end, I'm afraid.
Yeah. But in the case of Harvey Dent, he does win that one. Harvey Dent actually does give up completely on sort of liberal values and modern ways of looking at the world, and decides that the Joker has a point. He's horribly disfigured. He's lost the woman in his life. The Joker sort of brings him down to his own level, as he says. And Harvey Dent decides to go out and just, well, it's that thing with flipping the coin. But essentially, he's going out and just gunning down all of the corruption on all of the people who've wronged him. Decided to no longer operate within the system. I'll just go, the woman that he loved has been blown to pieces, and he'll just go out and kill them for it. It's as simple as that. They get a 50-50 chance. You can't ask for more than that.
I think in that he's still a bit liberal. He's entirely too liberal to give him a 50-50 chance. But anyway, that's just me. That's just me talking. You know, and it would kind of ruin the whole Two-Face thing. Well, actually, no. If he just kept his fake coin and went out, heads you lose. You know, and it's heads on both sides. That would have been more to my liking. But anyway,
and it leads, of course, because the Harvey Dent character was never my favorite. But what it does is lead to building in a way they do. Clean up the corruption a little bit, but it's all based on a lie. And Bane arrives to expose the lie, and it all just comes crumbling down around them, especially with his revolution, of course. And we see once again that, like the Joker, Bane also has contempt for money, or the obsession with money. For him, especially for Bane, money is a tool to be used towards a higher purpose. It is not the end in and of itself. And I remember when it came out, so like 2012, the sort of the American neocon Republican right were outraged, because they said that Bane was, I mean, it's hard to imagine. This is a little example of how far sort of we, the dissident right, has come over the years, where Bane, actually, when The Dark Knight Rises came out, Bane was thought to have been a leftist. And now he's like one of the most common sort of far-right memes that you see. But the reason why they thought that was because Bane robs Wall Street, and he kills the bankers. And at the time, these sort of boomer neocon Republican types in America were outraged by that. Therefore, this is far left propaganda. He's got no respect for Wall Street. I mean,
yeah, there's a really good essay in this volume. It's co-authored by Gregory Hood and Luke Gordon. It's called Conservatism's League of Stupidity. And it talks about this kind of idiocy from the mainstream right. Specifically referring to Ben Shapiro, actually. Little Ben Shapiro thought that Christopher Nolan was a great defender of capitalism by showing, you know, this horrible Occupy Wall Street monster villain, Bane. And you know, it's an amazingly bad reading of the film, as this article shows, because it shows that, you know, Bane is actually right about most things, and he's actually a more consistently heroic figure than Batman himself.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll just point out as well, you're never ever going to see a man as masculine and as tough as Bane in Antifa. It's never ever going to happen.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He doesn't look like anybody who is involved in Occupy Wall Street, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Yes, no, Bane's not a leftist. When was the last time you saw a leftist like that? But he, of course, he beats Batman to a pulp as well, because Batman's become a bit of a hermit. And Batman has to go back through that sort of, he has to overcome himself all over again, which is admirable.
I mean, he's truly heroic. He just doesn't finally get it in some way. He's still hemmed in by this liberal humanist value system. But yeah, he basically is he's destroyed and he's basically dies and is resurrected and overcomes the himself. And it's an interesting way of self-overcoming. It's the opposite. Instead of overcoming fear, he has to reignite fear and use fear as the way to finally get out of this prison, to try and climb up without a safety rope, to fully activate all of his animal energies. You know, so if you know there's no net, you have to really go all out.
Yeah. And he goes back to Gotham and saves the day. Well, they are going to nuke Gotham. The ending of The Dark Knight Rises is a bit confusing as well. I mean, what did you make of the ending? So Batman, I think in one of the articles at Countercurrents, what I liked was the idea, which we kind of took, because there is a symmetry. The Bane is the League of Nations reborn. The middle part with the Joker, it kind of goes off on one a little bit, where it's the typical sort of three-act structure, where the middle one, like, say, Empire Strikes Back in Star Wars, is where everything goes to hell. And the third part is trying to put the pieces back together a little bit. It's a kind of standard trope that you see. And at the end of it all, there is this idea where Batman has gone off with Catwoman and he's living a nice life, but then Robin, but he's not, he's a policeman, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I think he's called, and he discovers the cave and everything, and the cycle is going to repeat itself, because you're going to have a good man who's going to sacrifice himself and give his life once again for these sort of football-obsessed, popcorn-munching morons, which are the rank and file of Gotham's. It's a bitter way to end it, I think.
Yeah. It's an ambiguous end. It's definitely an ambiguous end. Instead of completely abandoning liberal humanism, you know, he fakes his death. You know, he seems to have sacrificed his life. He saves the city from the blast. And then he feels like he's given enough, you know, and he wants to go off and have an actual life. And that seems to be a rejection of the role of the superhero, but then he makes it possible for another person to step into that role. And so, you know, they're going to keep trying to keep liberal democracy and modernity limping along and save it from itself again. And so I think that it gets you very, very close to rejecting that value system. But yeah. No, in a way it doesn't, because, you know, the great bourgeois dream is everyone retires, right?
Yeah.
Everyone retires and has a private life in the end, where they do things like fishing or golf. You know, I love the attitude of a lot of Americans in the military. You know, American military people, you know, they if they're really serious about it, if they have a career in the military, they're willing to put their lives on the line and stuff like that. But when they retire, it's very, very strange. They get this attitude, you know, I've done my time, and then they just, the ones that I've known, have just dissipated the rest of their lives in, you know, fishing and golfing and hobbies and stuff like that. And it's the most anticlimactic, anti-heroic end to a life that, you know, is centered on the ethos of sacrificing yourself for the common good. Right, you know, so the police, they all want to retire on their pensions and things like that. So in a way, I guess the end is really actually, yeah, it's just the bourgeois dream, you know, the public servant
retires retires to his hobbies, whatever Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle are going to be doing in Florence. You know, it's not going to be trying to make the world a better place. And of course, you know, they aren't trying to make the world a better place. The deep, terrible truth is that the world would probably become a better place if there was a hard reset, which is what the League of Shadows is all about.
Mm-hmm. Because the people like the Joker or Bane or Ra's al Ghul, they understand that Batman is a noble spirit. They just think he's wrong-headed. And it's that it's all kind of futile. They do understand that he is a higher man and they're worthy of respect. It's not like sort of Jack Nicholson's Joker, for example, which in my view was much more psychotic and vindictive than the Heath Ledger Joker. He was generally unpleasant and horrible character, the Jack Nicholson Joker, I thought. He you can imagine him like torturing Batman to death in that film if he could have.
He's just a psychopath, and he doesn't have any redeeming characteristics. Whereas the fact that Heath Ledger's Joker is a psychopath is almost sort of like it's merely a toll that we have to pay in the modern system to hear some really hard anti-liberal, anti-modern moral truths, come. On the screen, right? So he's very much like the character of Bill the Butcher in Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
Bill the Butcher has some fantastic truths to say, but they're only sayable in the mouth of a monster by the rules of contemporary society. But you have to give credit to somebody like Scorsese or somebody like Christopher Nolan for willing, you know, they'll play by the rules to get these things out there, but they do get these things out there. And that's what makes these movies so thought-provoking. And I think they're going to be considered classics. I honestly think that Christopher Nolan is the greatest living filmmaker today.
Yes, I think I'd agree. I mean, Scorsese, I really like Scorsese as well.
I agree. He's in an older generation. Scorsese is a little bit up and down, I think, whereas I think Nolan is more consistent, maybe. But Scorsese is truly a genius. He's a great, great filmmaker. He's certainly the greatest filmmaker of his generation who's alive today, and I do think that Nolan.
Because Nolan came back to the same theme in Interstellar, where again it was as if it was like egalitarian was likened to this. I forgot what he called it. Like this, the blight. Where everything in society, in the world, while it was in America, had just kind of decayed and broken down. It was just like a big dust bowl, and the only hope was to sort of launch humanity off into the stars. But they couldn't get that done for health and safety reasons, or whatever. They just weren't allowed to do anything. It was similar again. A sort of similar theme again.
Yeah. I think Interstellar is an incredibly thoughtful film. I think Inception is one of the most brilliant, multi-layered sort of imaginative thrillers ever created. I have a review of it where I describe it as sort of, it's like Vertigo plus The Matrix in some ways. It's a truly magnificent film. And I think Dunkirk, a very different film than these others, was a truly masterful piece of cinema too, and really in some ways one of the most avant-garde films to ever become a major blockbuster hit. I likened it to Italian futurism. This is an Italian futurist film, in many ways made today, just in terms of its amazing avant-garde style, and yet it's emotionally tremendously powerful. And in fact, I think it's his most powerful film yet.
I love the scenes in sort of Dorset and Devon, where you had this train sort of running through old England, which is the kind of year you go back to.
After all this, you know, this rattle and hum and the mechanism of war, the ships, you know, the airplanes, this is all the Italian futurist technological element to it. Then you get back, and the soundtrack is, you know, electronic drones and crashes and everything. And then you get back to green and pleasant England, and suddenly that electronic noise melts into Elgar's Nimrod variation.
Yes, beautiful.
I just totally lost it. That was one of the most powerful moments in any movie. And he, you know, you realize, oh my God, he's been building towards this emotional climax quite steadily for, you know, 90 minutes or more. It's truly remarkable work. And it's also not political. It is a totally apolitical movie about World War II. You know, as opposed to Finest Hour, which was just a dreadful piece of a vomit-inducing, you know, Hollywood, you know, Allied propaganda about heroic Churchill and all that kind of stuff. This movie could have been so bad, but instead it was remarkably good. It's art. You know.
It's not Saving Private Ryan, where you've got like a 17-year-old Matt Damon with his blonde locks going up against German soldiers with skinheads who are all 42 with scars on their faces. Yeah. It's just this most ridiculous, obvious propaganda.
Right.
It's not that at all. Yeah.
I mean, the Germans aren't even referred to as Germans. They're just referred to as the enemy. And the situation is, you know, they're plunked down in the situation, and they're menaced. They're away from home. And really, the movie is not about those evil Germans. It's about home, right? And I, in a way, I think that's a profoundly nationalistic and subversive message today. And of course, it was roundly attacked because it was a movie about white Englishmen and white Frenchmen, basically.
Yes, it had no diversity in it, and it was really dragged over the coals for that.
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous achievement. So I, you know, every time he does a movie, I'm going to be there the very first day. You know,
What would you say the common theme of Christopher Nolan's films are? What is there something that you would say connects, say, the Dark Knight trilogy and Interstellar and Inception with Dunkirk? Is there something they all have in common besides beautiful cinematography?
You know, that's a really, really interesting question. I'm trying to think of other films that he did, like The Prestige, which is a very serious film. It's sort of, it lacks the dramatic power of the others, but it's still a very, very serious and interesting film. There is Insomnia, which I think is quite worthwhile. I'm trying to think of some of the others. Memento. That's a very interesting film.
He does play around with reality a bit, which he did as well in the Dark Knight movies, but it was a sort of moral reality which was being questioned and viewed at, which sort of made your major mind bend a little bit, especially with the Joker, of course.
Yeah. I mean, what I see in him, I don't think see so many common themes, I suppose, but I would like to ponder this more. It's something that I don't think I can give you a quick answer to, but clearly the guy is a highly educated man. He has a humanistic education. He's clearly read philosophy and a lot of great literature. And he's a master of the film craft, of the film art, and he constantly uses this to create serious films that aren't just PC claptrap like they could fall into over and over again. All of these films could have some kind of politically correct moralizing that they don't. And the fact that he never goes there for that cheap, easy appeal, you know, that a lot of these filmmakers go to, means that, for one thing, I don't think he believes that kind of stuff. I think Jonathan Nolan and Christopher Nolan are in some ways quite red-pilled about a lot of important issues. But of course, they got to keep it esoteric if they're going to keep making big budget films and TV series. But I do think they're among the two brightest and most serious people making popular culture, and the stuff they create is not by the numbers politically correct. The only things that they do that are kind of by the numbers PC is that they will have, you know, in many cases where it's appropriate, at least, multiracial casts. But, you know, I can't hate the black, actor.
Morgan Freeman.
It's impossible to hate him. He's great in the role that he plays, Lucius Fox. He sort of
cleverly sidesteps as well. So one of the main rules in Inception was by the Japanese actor Ken Watanabe or something, I think he's called. And he's like a genuinely great actor. He actually is really interesting to watch. And so, but on the other hand, Nolan can't be sort of called up. He can't be pulled on the fact that he hasn't got diversity, because he can always just say, well, as a Japanese man in like the second most prominent role in the movie. And it's a sort of, what they really mean is that we need to have like urban youths.
Stereotype. That's what they want, and he doesn't deliver that. He really doesn't, and that I think is very, very important. So yeah, I do think on some level the Nolan brothers are red pilled. I don't think they're not PC liberals. They might be liberals in some sense, but they're certainly not leftist PC people, because they consistently avoid the easy way, which is to get good reviews and by just doing PC morality tales. They just don't do that. They want to do something more interesting, and because of that, I think they're creating works that will last for a long, long time. I think that in 100 years, people are going to be watching Christopher Nolan's films, and there'll be film festivals and books and things like that, that he's going to be considered a serious artist like Akira Kurosawa or Ingmar Bergman. Yeah, he's going to be considered among the great serious directors.
Yeah. Nobody now was talking about the first Captain America film or, you know, whatever X-Men movie came out in 2008. Nobody cares. They're long gone. But yet, I like watching movie analysis on YouTube and stuff, and people are still constantly trying to find something new to talk about in the Dark Knight trilogy. I think it is because the themes that's in it, which resonate with European people, even at a sort of subconscious level, they may not be, you know, talking about Julius Evola and the League of Shadows or seeing the Joker as a Heideggerian supervillain or whatever, but it does resonate with them more than the sort of cookie cutter standard mass produced rubbish of the what usually passes. And people say they're sick to death of superhero movies, and I can totally understand why, but you have to give credit where credit's due. Some of it, the Dark Knight is not really, it's something more than that, I'd say.
Yeah. They're serious literature, if you will. They're serious films. No one will be continuing to do Captain America memes and things like that, but people are going to be Bane posting well into the next century, I guarantee it.
Yeah. I've got a super chat to read out, and I'm happy to leave it there if you like, Greg. Ganji Blob Flankus for £5. Here's a fiver to hear my nonsense pseudonym in your glorious accent. Thank you for dragging me beyond outrage towards meaning. Love your work. Well, thank you very much, Ganji Blob Flankus. Much appreciated. Thanks very much for coming on, Greg.
There was one little question that I saw roll by, which is, what do I think of the upcoming Joker film? There's a trailer for it.
Yeah.
And I'm formulating, I'm definitely going to be out there the first day to see it. I think that this could be very, very good. But I think that it could be very, very good in a way by accident, in a way the script writer, the director, the main actor in this upcoming Joker movie are all Jewish. And I think the character of the Joker is they're going to humanize him basically by writing a story about, a person that's projecting a sort of outsider, a victimized outsider character that's sort of a standard trope in Jewish literature. And they're doing this, and I think they could do it really, really well, and they could make him very, very human. And of course, he becomes a monster, and he's humanizing the monster, et cetera, et cetera. And they feel comfortable doing this because they feel like they're outsiders. And they're sort of on autopilot because now they're the ultimate insiders. And this character that was not is going to appeal to white guys more broadly, because white guys are now the designated outsiders, wow, and villains in our society. So I think it's going to resonate a great deal with alienated white guys, but it's not necessarily their intention. But I think that's what's coming down the pike. And so I think it could be a very interesting case of a movie that is highly, highly potent culturally and will have a great kind of resonance with a white male audience, but that's really not the intention necessarily of the filmmakers.
Yeah. I just watched the teaser for the new Star Wars has gone up as well.
I haven't seen it yet. As soon as I get off this live stream, I'm going to go watch it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we can do it like at the end of the year, have another talk and not be as flattering this time. But they've brought Lando Calrissian back, so you've got this kind of chubby old black man flying the Millennial Falcon. Oh, God, it just looks so bad.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have written some of the most scathing, vitriolic dissections of these recent Star Wars movies that have ever been penned, and also the Solo. I did think that Rogue One was actually a pretty good film, but the new trilogy and also Solo were really, really bad. And now Jar Jar Abrams is back at the helm to wrap up this ghastly, horrible trilogy, and I imagine it's going to be really bad. Because he's not a good director. He is a by-the-numbers derivative schlockmeister. But it's all calculated to squeeze as much money as possible. But at the same time, they want to spit on the Star Wars franchise, the Star Wars universe, the Star Wars fans. There's a YouTuber, and I can't remember his name, or because it's just like a couple letters and punctuation signs, and it's just not coming to me. Google the farce and gorges, and look at the stuff that he's done about the new Star Wars movies, because he really masterfully shows that they systematically deconstruct the original trilogy and try and turn the original trilogy and then the prequel trilogy too, the original six films, they basically turn all the strivings and heroism of that saga by Lucas, which has affected a lot of people, and they basically deconstruct it and turn it into a farce. And it's so systematic that you have to look at it and just say it's E:R. Okay, thank you, folks in the chat. It's E:R. And they're spitting on the audience, they're spitting on the franchise, and they're trying to milk as much money from it as possible. It's disgusting. It's truly evil what they've done.
It is. I don't want to wait. I don't care for spoiler, but one of the main, like you picked up on it as well, and these huge channels. I mean, the Star Wars thing really deserves a whole separate conversation. But what's really interesting is that, you know, we spoke just earlier about the power of the internet, and it is the power of the internet which is kneecapped the what they're doing with Star Wars. And you've got YouTube channels. They tend to be kind of centrists, and they'll get given not in the wink in our direction. They are careful with what they say. You know, we all are now. But they've really savaged the Star Wars reboots. And they've done it to huge audiences. Some of these videos have got more than 1 million views.
Yeah, yeah. And what's very interesting, and a story, an article needs to be written about this someday, is Gamergate. Gamergate is the template for what became the Disney Star Wars boycott that cost Disney hundreds of millions of dollars by tanking Solo. And, you know, it's the template. And, of course, it worked as a template because it's a rejection of feminism and political correctness across the board. And this sort of just pausing and deconstructing these things because of an SJW agenda. And, yeah, it was very interesting. A lot of these people who do these YouTube things, I forget some of their names, you know, they were obviously totally corrupted when the Force Awakens came out. You know, they were obviously given all kinds of freebies and stuff like that to puff this movie, and it was painful to listen to this kind of stuff because it was a god-awful, crappy derivative movie. And there were some independent voices. And then Rogue One came out, and it was actually a pretty good film. And so that sort of paused for a little while the critics. It paused me a bit because I thought it was actually a pretty good film. Yeah, you can criticize the casting and everything, which is standard. But just imagine everybody is white in that. And, you know, the story is actually quite excellent. It's not deconstructive in any way of the central themes that are good about Lucas's world. But anyway, then of course the Last Jedi comes out, and I didn't even think it was as bad as The Force Awakens, but by then people really realized that this was just spitting on them, and they got really, really, really angry, and that really mobilized this boycott on the Gamergate model. It was interesting. A lot of these YouTube channels that were that had puffed and shilled for the Force Awakens were more guarded about The Last Jedi because they were hearing the anger in the audience. You know, I remember some of them saying, "Oh yes, these SJWs, you know, haha." You know, they were trying to sort of be centrist and tap dance around this stuff, but they could feel the heat.
Yeah.
And it really snowballed a lot. And a lot of these YouTubers with huge, huge channels, they turned and they destroyed Solo. And it was easy to destroy Solo because it was a terrible movie. It was just really, really weak. But it was fascinating. And of course, the Gamergate thing is an anti-PC thing. It is an objectively rightist thing, and that was the nucleus, the template for what happened with Solo. And I think that's very, very valuable. And I frankly wish they got Kathleen Kennedy sacked. That would have been a tremendous victory. This is a horrible PC harridan. You know, and it would have been wonderful if this person lost her job and a couple hundred million dollars because of this populist fan insurrection. And it could have happened. It very well could have happened. And we will see what happens with this third movie. I think it's going to be tanked
by
the fans. I'm going to be pulling for that because I know Jar Jar Abrams' character. He's a horrible derivative. Like I said, he's a schlockmeister, and there's not a single cell of artistic originality in that man. That's not
the battle over Star Wars is, and you know why, like men like me and you are talking about this stuff, is that it's because it's a microcosm of something much larger. Yeah. You can see that Star Wars is like the empire. The elites are peddling this rubbish to the audience, and then you've got the rebellion against it, and then so it's as if it's the whole situation in the Western world, and it's the same ideology as well.
Yeah,
it's the same ideology, and what in the new one of the things that everybody picked up on, and these, you know, these critics, was in U2 is that the main girl called Ray is a Mary Sue. She can just do everything, and everybody went to town on that. In the new trailer, in the new teaser trailer, which came out a couple of hours ago, it opens with her in a desert with a lightsaber, and there's a TIE fighter coming towards her along the desert floor, and then she like flips up and does like a huge somersault 30 feet in the air, and you can see that it looks like she's gonna like cut it in half or something.
Yeah, spare me, please.
It's as if, yeah, we've heard your criticisms, we've seen all the millions upon millions of YouTube videos complaining about this ridiculous feminist message, but you know what? Fuck you. We're going to do it again anyway.
We're going to rub your noses in it. Yeah. And eventually this is going to bite them. It's going to come around and bite them. God, wouldn't it have been amazing if they got somebody like Christopher Nolan to direct the latest Star Wars trilogy? It could have been truly great. I want Nolan to direct a Bond film. I think that would be amazing. If he directed a Bond film, it would be as good as Skyfall, if not better. And Skyfall is really one.
Yeah, Skyfall was great. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I've enjoyed this. Let's just make a regular habit of talking about films. If you want to do it, I'd love to. I'm in the right now. I made an agreement with Ron Unz to do two movie reviews a month for him. February was a bad month for me, so I'm going to bring out four this month at the Unz Review. So this year I'm going to be writing a lot more, basically 24 film reviews this year. So there's a lot to talk about. One of those will definitely be the new Star Wars. But there's not a lot of new stuff that's really out in the theaters. So I'm reviewing a lot of older films that I really like too. I'm writing something on David Lynch's Dune right now.
Oh, good.
It's at more than 4,000 words. I think it's going to be like 6,000 words by the time it's done. So I'm doing a lot of Lynch.
That's going to be a movie as well. I think so. I think that's gone into production for a new movie as well.
Denis Villeneuve is directing it. The guy who did I was kind of disappointed with that Blade Runner 2049 film. Honestly, I really thought his previous what was it called? He did a sci-fi movie before that. It was really quite good. John Morgan and I did a podcast about it, and the name is just not coming to mind. But yeah, I think he could do a good job on Dune. I hope he does. So we'll see.
We'll definitely see. And yeah, we'll definitely have a chat about the Star Wars when it comes out. And I'm looking forward to Game of Thrones as well. I may do a video on that.
I'm actually going to do a Guide to Culture episode every week for the next few weeks with Frody Midyord and John Morgan about each new episode of the Game of Thrones season coming out. Because unless it's just so terrible that we don't want to talk about it at all, there's going to be a Guide to Culture episode out this weekend about the new Rammstein video, Deutschland. That should be really, really interesting. That's on YouTube, and it's also will be at Countercurrent. So keep your eyes open for the next GTK episode, Guide to Culture.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much in the chat there. Thanks a lot for the super chats. I think we'll get back for another movie discussion another time. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
Okay. Bye, everybody.